Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why would anyone become a terrorist? Most of us can't imagine any belief that would compel us to join a militant jihadist group willing to kill to achieve its objectives. But as my guest today learned through interviews with more than 100 extremists across the Muslim world, the motivation of these young men and women are often personal as well as political. Ken Ballin is a former federal prosecutor and congressional investigator and current president of the not-for-profit organization he founded called Terror Free Tomorrow. His new book is called Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. Ken, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
So the title of your book is Terrorists in Love, but it's interesting because in so many of these stories, the reality is that they are terrorists thwarted in love or denied love. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's right. I mean, they can't have the love that they're looking to find on Earth. There's a story in the book of a jihadi Romeo and Juliet in Saudi Arabia. A young man falls in love with a young woman, what we would think of as a very natural, everyday occurrence. Well, it's not in that society. He falls in love with her. He's madly in love. He courts her for 5 years every day, goes to her window, literally, and they dream of a life together, but their dreams are thwarted because the young man, Abby, doesn't have a $30,000 dowry or a payment that's required in that society to marry this young woman. So her father instead marries her off to a man over 60 years old who happens to have $35,000 to pay for her, and literally it's a transaction. He loses the love of his life, and he goes off to fight in holy war because he has this deep belief that if he fights and dies for God, then he'll be rewarded by going to heaven. And in heaven, he can pick whomever he wants to marry. And literally, he can marry his love in heaven.
And he's hoping that she will join him in this effort.
Well, she actually, it's interesting because she independently, he's not hoping that he's hoping to meet her in heaven.
In heaven, okay.
But she actually on her own reads his poem to her on the internet and decides that she too must escape from this man who she feels rapes her and has her by force rather than by her own will, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
And so she tries to escape from him. She does escape from him and tries to go off. So she has the same notion that if she dies in holy war, that she'll be rewarded and then she can marry her love in heaven. It's a tragic story. It is a jihadi Romeo and Juliet because they both end up in this kind of a whirlwind of their beliefs hurtling them towards death as the only way they can find love on Earth.
And when you talked to this young man, in fact, he had no idea where she was or if, in fact, she was dead or alive.
Well, that's right. We don't know. Not only did he have no idea, but the authorities in Saudi Arabia don't know what happened to her, which is not as unusual as it might seem, because when a woman escapes from her assigned man, she drops into this kind of netherworld where her life is no longer worthwhile to anyone and people lose track of her. She might have been sold into white slavery or another form. There she might have even gotten back, the man may have reclaimed her and erased her identity from any kind of public records. So we just don't know what happened to her. And it's sad story. And you know what's interesting, too, about the story is when the young man goes to Iraq to fight against the United States, to be in holy war, he discovers that the jihad is not a jihad from God because the leaders of Al-Qaeda are stealing. They're killing for sectarian and personal and political reasons. They're killing for money to become enrich themselves. So he becomes very disillusioned. And he meets another young Iraqi who tells him, you know, this is not a war for God, and if you die, you're not going to go to heaven at all. You'll probably end up in hell. So he escapes from Iraq and goes through quite an ordeal before he's brought back home.
Well, and that's another fascinating, striking refrain throughout the book, is that some of the people who become terrorists wake up at some point and realize that it's not only about this glorious fight for what they think God wants from them. It's about human beings who have human desires that are not necessarily anything to be celebrated.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, and this is kind of an untold, as you point out, untold refrain or theme in the book, is that we see, the book really shows us for the first time from the inside what jihad is like, and it's not glamorous. There's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of lying and manipulation and double dealing, and a lot of these young men are terribly idealistic. They get involved in this struggle, and then they see what it's really like, and they become quite disillusioned with it. And this is a real opportunity for us in the West and in the Muslim world as well to tell the inside story of what it's really like, because that, I think, would discourage people from joining it to begin with and hurt the ranks of these holy warriors.
Do you think
when people see it's not so holy?
Do innocent, moderate people in the Middle East who happen to be Muslim, I mean, do they understand the motivations of the terrorists that grow up within their communities any better than we do in the West?
I think they do. I mean, because, you know, this is just a kind of a more committed way of, they see it as being a good Muslim and maybe carrying it to an extreme. But these people come from their own culture and their own belief system. So I do think they understand it more, and that's why sometimes you see a failure to condemn it, because there is more of an understanding of it. And I think that understanding can benefit us as well, because if you really understand people's motives, you can respond in ways that are more effective, as I was saying before, about responding to the corruption. I mean, some people say, well, you know, what are you doing? You're sympathizing with terrorists, and this is a horrible thing. You know, I used to be a federal prosecutor. I prosecuted terrorists. I prosecuted organized crime figures. I prosecuted drug dealers, child molesters. The only way you can successfully prosecute people is to understand them. And I think that's something we failed to do largely since 9/11. And I don't think sympathy doesn't mean condoning the actions. Mm-hmm. It means understanding them so you can respond more effectively.
How did you come to take on this project of tracking down and interviewing terrorists?
Well, I came to take it on mainly for the reason I just said, which is that I founded after 9/11, several years after 9/11, a research group that was looking into the causes of extremism, because I really felt that that wasn't being done adequately. And the kind of prosecutor model of understanding first before responding wasn't being accomplished as well. So I started this organization. We began with a lot of public opinion polling in the Muslim world that hadn't been done. And as part of that research, I began interviewing terrorists. And, you know, I have a history of almost two decades doing this with criminals and other folks like that, so it wasn't terribly unusual to me. And the book kind of wrote itself, because the more and more people I interviewed, the more surprised I became. All my assumptions, and I considered myself somewhat of a so-called expert in this area, but when I actually talked to people, all that expertise was lost, and all my assumptions, everything I thought I knew kind of went out the window, and I felt, wow, I just have to share these stories with my fellow countrymen and other people in the West, because we really just don't understand what's going on at all here. We're operating in the dark still, 10 years after 9/11.
We have an email here from Tamara, who wants to know why the terrorist you describe, and I think she's talking here about Abby, not turn his anger to the society and religion that denies him the chance to marry for love and treats women as property to be sold. Why turn that anger outward?
Well, because, because you grow up, he was a very devout Muslim, so it wasn't a question of turning his anger inward. I mean, he didn't feel anger. He felt that this was the will of God and that he was going to follow the will of God. And it's not like he's sitting there, rejecting the society that he's growing up in, because he sees that as religiously based. And his story is not unique. There's another story in the book of Ahmad, who also leaves from Saudi Arabia, ends up blowing himself up in Iraq, survives his suicide attack, and is taken to Abu Ghraib, of all places, you know, the infamous prison, and the one that run by the U.S. Army that, in fact, had caused Ahmad to want to go to Saudi Arabia to fight in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So he's scared to death when he gets there. Yet instead of being tortured, he is treated by kindness, and he meets the first woman ever outside his own family an army medic who helps nurse him back to health and turns this fellow who was an Al-Qaeda guy from being anti-American into fiercely pro-American, in fact.
When you talk about their encounters with corruption within these terrorist organizations, I think Ahmad's story is really illustrative in that respect, because essentially what happens is he is trying to regain his father's approval. Let's step back for a minute and talk about why he felt that was necessary.
Well, I think there's two reasons he felt it was necessary. One, any person, one wants to gain their father's approval.
Right.
I mean, I think that's a natural human reaction. You grow up in a family, you want your father's approval. He was very close to his mother, so he already had his mother's approval. He was very close to his grandfather. He would see his grandfather almost every day. But his father and he had a very difficult relationship. So anyone here growing up wants to be close to their father, too. I think that's a natural human reaction. But also in that society, the father is really the most important figure in the family, and to have a father's approval, particularly as an eldest son, is considered a sine qua non to your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So wanting to gain his father's approval, having a very difficult relationship with his father, I think was the psychological factor that really eventually propelled him towards holy war and jihad. I mentioned earlier the photos of Abu Ghraib. Now, that was the kind of catalyst, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't react for just seeing photos on the Internet. I think that's kind of a myth. They have a deep psychological, deep cultural, deep religious background. And like all of us, unless you explore what that is, you really get only a very superficial sense of what their motivations are.
So Ahmad signs on with this terrorist organization and I suppose imagines that he will finally find his place here, and then realizes that he's not really making friends. He feels sort of socially isolated, and ultimately is treated by the organization as essentially disposable.
As essentially, I missed the last
disposable
word you said, but as essentially human cannon fodder,
yeah, yeah,
is how he's treated. I mean, he is. And this is not a unique experience. It's a very interesting scene in the book. He arrives in Iraq with 45 other young men from all over the Arab world, and they're gathered in a room, and this is Al-Qaeda he's fighting for, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And he is told by an Al-Qaeda leader, exhorted, really, I want you young men to join the jihad and die in glory for God and commit yourself to suicide attacks. And he's given this tremendous speech, and not a single one of the 45 people sitting in the room volunteer for a suicide attack.
Mm-hmm.
Not one. And the Al-Qaeda leader is visibly frustrated, according to Ahmad. And what then happens is he's kept in kind of an isolation for months. He's not trained to fight. He's not given any kind of inspiration. He's very socially isolated. He's dragged from one location to another, and eventually, he's so desperate to do anything, he kept saying, well, let me volunteer for something. And he's essentially tricked into this suicide mission, which I found was not unusual. A lot of people recounted that.
Let me jump in here. We'll take a quick break and get the rest of that story in a moment. My guest this hour is Ken Ballin. He is president and founder of the not-for-profit organization Terror Free Tomorrow. His new book is called Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ken Ballin. He's a former federal prosecutor and congressional investigator, now president of the not-for-profit organization he founded, Terror Free Tomorrow. His new book is called Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So before the break, Ken, you were telling us the story of Ahmad, who was essentially duped into what turned out to be a suicide mission, and the story of how he suddenly realizes what he is intended to do is just horrifying.
It is horrifying. He gets up in the morning. There's a lot of details in the book that I don't want to relay, but really give it quite a context. I mean, he is promised by the Al-Qaeda leader. He's missing his family terribly. He's in isolation in Iraq. He's 19 years old. He wants nothing more. He was told when he left Saudi Arabia and his family that he couldn't let them know where he was going. So he wants nothing more than to communicate with them that he's alive and okay. And the Al-Qaeda leader, oh, I promise to do that for you. I promise to call your father as soon as you're done with this mission where you're just going to deliver a truck, and he rides with two other young Iraqis, and it's the first people who've talked to him in the entire time he's been in Iraq. So he feels kind of comforted at last. He has some human connection, and they're driving along in Baghdad, and as he describes it, 1,000 yards before he gets to what he sees as a concrete barrier ahead, the two Iraqi jihadis jump out of the truck. He can do nothing but grab hold of the steering wheel, otherwise the truck would go out of control. He grabs hold of it, and in less than 20 seconds, the truck, which is carrying 26 tons of liquid explosives, detonates and kills 8 people, injures scores of others, and injures himself. He somehow miraculously survives, but he is badly burned and badly injured as a result.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Edward in Dallas. Hi, Edward.
Good morning, and thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you so much for this book interview. It's a very interesting sounding book. I was wondering about the average age of the young men or women that end up as terrorists. I wondered if they were mostly teenagers or people in their 20s. Do you think that those age groups could be more easily duped and tricked into jihadist actions?
The caller is absolutely right. The almost everyone involved in this movement, at least at first, is a young man and several young women, and they usually start at the age, sometimes younger, but usually at 16 through 28, and that is the window. And if you think of it, it's not terribly unusual, and I guess I know this as a former prosecutor. People involved in crime in the United States all tend to be young men between those ages. And this is, I don't know, something about, that's part of why the title, Terrorists in Love, something about hormones at that age, something about confusion, about wanting to make your mark in the world. That's the kind of vulnerable window. Once you get past, 30, then there's very little danger of you becoming a terrorist or becoming a criminal. I'm not saying it never happens, but, you're easily 90% of the people fall into that age group.
It's so interesting, Ken, because a few weeks ago we did a story with a National Geographic reporter about the teenage brain, and it was not about teenage terrorists. It was about, garden variety American kids getting into trouble. And, there's this idea that the prefrontal cortex is still forming until you're 25, and that even among U.S. law-abiding, risk-taking teenagers, they don't want to die, and they don't think it's impossible for them to die. They just get a great thrill out of the idea of this risk.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And it's not that they want to die. It's sometimes, and they don't really understand their own mortality. They consider themselves, it's somehow not as much of a reality to them. And I don't know the scientific reasons for that, but that's certainly what I uncovered. And the thrill of it, that is definitely described in the book. I mean, we talked about Ahmad, and the Romeo and Juliet and the suicide bomber who survives the attack. But others from Pakistan described to me, just the thrill of being involved in this, very exciting. I mean, when there's no other opportunities where there's a lot of drudgery in the culture. This one man said this to me, you know, there's so much boredom, and this is exciting. This is and this is, I'm doing good. It's an exciting adventure. I'm getting everything paid for me. I'll go to heaven. My family will go to heaven. You know, why not?
So talk a little bit about how you found some of these people. You did have a sort of partnership with the Saudi Rehabilitation Center. Can you tell us about that organization?
Yes. I wouldn't call it a partnership, though, Chris. I mean, I had access. I developed a friendship with a very high-ranking counterterrorism official from Saudi Arabia. And during a time, they set up in Saudi Arabia, initially this program was set up to receive inmates from Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
But they expanded it to cover all kinds of radicals, and their idea was to set up a program to try to rehabilitate these guys. So for a while, they opened up that program to Western reporters, and I think that I had more access than almost anyone else to interviewing people there, and that accounts for two of the stories in the book. The other four I met through other means, it's about a third of the book.
What sort of opening questions do you use with an accused or an avowed jihadist radical?
The opening questions are the softest ones.
Uh-huh.
Usually, I spent a long time, and this is, you know, with each of these people, and, you know, days, weeks, months for some of them, I was talking to them. And I start out very soft. I said, tell me about your grandfather, tell me about your town you can't come from, tell me about your family, tell me about your interests. I mean, I don't think I ever once asked the question, why did you become a terrorist?
Right.
You know, and this is the approach that works. And people like, first of all, people like to talk about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's a universal trait. No matter who you talk to, that's everyone's favorite topic is themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing, and most of these people, if they come from a deep religious conviction, they want to share that with you, and also a lot of them have some kind of sense of guilt as well, and so they feel the need to explain their actions to other people.
Were there any conditions placed on their willingness to talk to you?
None.
Hmm.
And, you know, I should also point out that for many of these people, it was the first time they had met an American before, and I'm also Jewish, and it's the first time they had ever met a Jew. Not for many of them, for all of them that was true. But, you know, that in a strange way was an advantage. People think, oh, well, why would they talk to you? Well, it was an advantage because in their own culture, some of the intimate things they told me would cause them much shame and cause them to lose face, whereas they felt to an outsider they could be freer in talking. It was also, at some point, I would tell them, you know, I would discuss the fact that I'm an American. I would discuss the fact that I'm Jewish. And that also provoked it was unsettling to them. And that's good in an interview. You want to unsettle people at a certain point when a certain amount of trust is developed.
You did have one of your subjects. Was it Malik who made a direct reference to Daniel Pearl?
Well, it wasn't Malik. It was another one, Shahid. He came from a cell that later was involved in the bombing of the Marriott Hotel in Pakistan, and his group had Googled me on the internet, and they had wanted him, when he met me, they had talked about luring me away from the hotel and possibly what they described as doing another Daniel Pearl. And for your listeners, that, you know, Daniel Pearl was a Wall Street Journal reporter who in Pakistan was lured into a trap and killed by al-Qaeda.
Why do you think, I mean, obviously you were taking precautions, but why do you think that you were not harmed?
Well, I, as I said, I did take precautions, and you know, maybe, I think I was fairly careful, but it's not a risk-free endeavor to do this, and one of the people in the book has said to me, if I were you, Ken, I wouldn't be taking any vacation soon in our stately mountains of Pakistan, because in our part of the world, accidents happen, even if coincidences seldom do.
So what did it take to connect with the terrorists that were still out there and walking around at their own recognizance, and how did you set up those meetings?
carefully.
Which is why you're here to talk about it, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've done a lot of work in Pakistan, and in fact, our public opinion surveys were front page news in that country. So I had contacts within the media in Pakistan and contacts among those people who knew radicals and radical clerics. So it was networking through those folks that I made the connections and set up the interviews.
So another really heartbreaking story in this book is that of Kamal, who has access to great wealth, but has something very much working against him, particularly within his own culture. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. What he has working against him is his, you know, the book is entitled, again, Terrorists and Love. And there's a website, by the way, it's called terroristandlove.com.
Thank you.
So it's where people can learn about the book. But anyway, what Kamal, as you say, he grows up in great wealth and great privilege. He's actually part of the royal family in Saudi Arabia. But instead of having a forbidden love with another woman, he falls in love with his first cousin, who happens to be a man. And this is not accepted in the culture. Not accepted that he could actually live with this person and actually proclaim his love. And they're separated by, again, their fathers. And launches him into a great sense of feeling alienated and wanting to find a different outlet for his feelings.
Was he entirely frank with you at the start about his sexuality?
No, he was not. He did not. That took a while for him to disclose.
Mm-hmm.
And it only came after some time. No, believe me, it was not the first thing he told me.
How is an interview as a journalist or as a pollster different from the sort of interview that you would have done as a prosecutor?
For me, it wasn't different, and that's, I think, what made it. I approached these the difference was, as a prosecutor, I would often have a hammer over someone. I could send them to prison, or I had some reason that motivated them to talk, and I didn't have that with these people. But other than that, I approached these interviews very much as I did with a prosecutor, as a prosecutor, which is with infinite patience. I had the luxury of not being on a deadline,
mm-hmm.
And not having to figure, you know, not having to file a story. So it didn't matter how much time I would spend with them. And, you know, people sometimes, you know, grow weary after a certain point, and then we'd start up the next or have a meal together. And I just, you know, of course it didn't work with everyone. Some people I met just gave me a lot of rhetoric, like listening to Osama bin Laden or something, and that was useless. And an hour or two after that, I ended the interview. And some people I spent a long time with, but their stories weren't terribly compelling or, frankly, that interesting. So this didn't work with everyone, but that's why you have only six people portrayed in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you go through and you sort of call from interviews that you've done with 100 people, there must be patterns that emerged that caused you to choose the six characters that you did. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. I really believe that these six people are representative of the various motivations that caused people to join the Holy War and that caused people to leave it as well. That's an important, there's a lot of hope in the book. There's some bleak stories, particularly in Pakistan, where kind of the center of gravity of this whole radical movement has moved. But there's some hope. There's really some hope. And, you know, you see with certain of the characters, we talked about that guy in Daniel Pearl, he actually went through somewhat of a metamorphosis meeting me and actually experiencing the humanity of the so-called enemy for the first time, kind of like Ahmad in Iraq when he met an American woman and other Americans who treated him kindly. So there's a lot of hope in the book, too. It's not just bleak. And it's a book about human beings. It's a book about emotions. It's a book about life as well as death. And within this kind of death culture, the life that still springs up and that you see and the hope that you can feel.
So you mentioned the reality that sometimes these young jihadists are isolated from their families and from their home communities. Is this the sort of thing that they would openly tell their families about if they could, or is it kept hidden?
Well, it's both, and they are isolated. I mean, you know, people ask, too, you know, what's the similarity to the criminals you prosecuted? Well, there is a similarity in a sense. There's a great difference because most of these people, not all, some are just venal and evil. I mean, I must say that. But most of them operating out of a sense of good and wanting to do the right thing. But they're like, this is reminding me very much like organized crime. They're kind of indoctrinated in this cult-like existence, and their family are cut off from their families, and they're have this kind of new group dynamic where the values become twisted around very quickly.
What did you learn about their notions of heaven and hell?
Their notions of heaven and hell are very literal. Heaven is a place where you can marry whomever you want. You can also have these 72 virgins. It's a very kind of literal place with everything that you can't have on earth. Wine and women and lush gardens and flowing water. And so it's a very literal place. Hell is a very literal place. And it's described in the book, and you're tortured endlessly. I mean, one reason, you remember the story of Romeo and Juliet, when his love is taken away from him and she's married against her will to this, in a very interesting, almost biblical way, if you read the book, to this old man, you know, the young guy, Abby, he's just distraught, and he thinks of suicide. He actually drives his Chrysler automobile to a cliff near his town and is thinking of driving straight off. And the only thing that stops him is the fact that he believes that if he drives the car off the cliff and dies, that he will live forever in hell, continually falling. He will never stop falling, because however you kill yourself on earth, which is a sin, that is repeated again and again in hell. So if you stab yourself, you keep stabbing yourself. If you jump off a cliff, you keep falling and falling and falling. And this notion that he would never stop falling dissuaded him from the suicide. At least that's what he reported to me.
Ken Ballin is our guest this hour. He's president and founder of the not-for-profit organization Terror Free Tomorrow. He's also the author of the new book, Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. If you'd like to join our conversation, do so now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former federal prosecutor Ken Ballin. He is president and founder of the not-for-profit organization Terror Free Tomorrow and author of the new book Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, ask a question. You can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ken, to what extent do you think sexual repression specifically, and I guess this is what we in the United States would characterize as sexual repression, and obviously the standards are different in other parts of the world, but from your observation, to what extent is that directly responsible for interest in terrorist organizations?
I think it's a big factor. You look at these stories, you look at the young jihadi Romeo and Juliet and Saudi Arabia, they never were able to consummate their love, and I think that almost made it a hyper-romantic kind of attachment. Ahmad had never met a woman before. He was a young man who left Saudi Arabia and became a suicide bomber and survived in Iraq. But before he left Saudi Arabia, he had spent a number of years in a gang, and they would go around and try to look at women from afar, but all women were in veil. So, I mean, they didn't have much success. You know, there's another story in the book of the fellow who I mentioned. We talked about Daniel Pearl. He was part of a cell in Pakistan, later involved in the Marriott bombing. In any event, this young man was raped by the headmaster of his school when he was 11 years old. Several years later, he too fell in love with a young woman from afar and was humiliated as a result of that and turned to religion for solace. And then we see the story of the young man in Saudi Arabia who fell in love with his first cousin who was a man. So in all of these stories, even the Taliban fellow who was acted like a seer for Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, told me how much he had to follow the will of God, how much he had tried to repress his sexual feelings, and then, you know, because it was right to keep women sheltered, it was right to keep women veiled, it was right to beat women who went to a tailor to get their clothes altered. I mean, you know, this was the world he grew up in, and the sexual repression envelops almost everything.
What did you learn about their impressions of you as an American Jew, someone they had never met the likes of before?
Well, you know, for some, it didn't make an impression. I mean, speaking of that fellow Malik, who was close to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, at the end of the interview, he took my hand in friendship and held my hand, which is a sign of friendship in that culture, and then proceeded to tell me how he believed that the word of God required that every single Jew had to be put to death, and that God required that. And here he's holding my hand in friendship, and he's telling me this. Yet for some other people, it was a transformative kind of experience. I met with this man, his name is Shahid, and he was the Taliban guy who was part of the cell that blew up the Marriott, but then he left it. And when he was with me, I had recounted to him a dream that I had. And he saw this dream as me having a vision of the Prophet Muhammad. And he was so moved by the fact that an American, a Jew, could have this kind of vision that it really caused him to alter his thinking. And it caused him to turn. He knew the Quran by heart. He knew every single passage in the Quran. He was so steeped in it. And which is a very exalted status for a Muslim to have that kind of knowledge. And by hearing me have this, how he interpreted this dream, he started quoting other passages of the Quran that called for tolerance and love, unlike that fellow who called for the killing. And he said, this is the real message. And it's proved to me by the fact that you had this dream. So he changed before my very eyes, and God, to be honest, it changed me, too, to have this kind of moving experience. That was the kind of experience that compelled me to write this book.
On the other hand, even given your experience and what you have learned sort of academically through studying the culture of terrorism and the political and ideological realities behind it, is it hard not to take it personally when someone says, "Ken, I really like you, but you know you're going to hell," right?
Oh, it's very hard not to take it personally. And in fact, at that moment I was telling you about that guy who was holding my hand in friendship and telling me how every Jew had to be killed. You know what? At that point, Chris, I was ready to end that interview.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Yeah. So what do we gain as Americans? And I'm talking here about just, you know, civilian Americans who don't necessarily have a direct impact on U.S. foreign policy. What do we gain by understanding these people that frighten us, that frankly threaten our safety?
I mean, that's a very interesting and it's an excellent question. And it's not the question I'm usually asked. The question I'm usually asked, so I applaud you for asking me, the question I'm usually asked is what do we gain policymakers? But I think what we gain from average Americans is being able, first of all, people may gain different things. There's not a didactic lesson that I have to draw for everyone to read this book. And some people may read it and come away thinking certain things, and some people may read it and come away thinking exactly diametrically the opposite point of view. So it's not that kind of book. It's not a policy book. It's not a book that's telling people how to think. So I think every one of your listeners who actually reads this book may come to different conclusions. But I think if you can open your hearts to see and open your minds to see where other people are coming from, it can create a bridge to some of them, not to all of them. As I mentioned, some are just going to be diametrically opposed and committed to our destruction as Americans, no matter what we do. But But they're not all like that, and that's the interesting thing about this. And I think this book can, you know, I it's not an easy book to write. For some people, it won't be an easy book to read, but it really can give you an insight and an opening of a different world, and one that you just not expecting at all to find.
What are moderate clerics doing who would like to be able to take in these lost souls before they turn to violence?
Yeah, I don't think they're doing enough, but they are. People are doing it, and people. What it involves is a more expansive, a more tolerant interpretation of the religion, and for many, that's the way they are leading forward. And what's interesting in the book is some people discover this on their own. Kamal, we talked about, the young man in Saudi Arabia, Shahid, who when he after he met me and heard that dream, he started focusing on other aspects of the Quran. And ultimately, the change has to come from Muslims themselves. This is not something America can impose on other people.
Which is such a hard thing to hear, because we want to believe that if we fully understand the problem, then we can, it's sort of in our nature to believe that we can set about fixing it.
No, well, we can't. And I think sometimes the more we try, the more it will backfire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to engage in dialogue. We have to defend ourselves in those instances where we need to defend ourselves. But we have to be careful about the use of force because it can, in the long run, create more adversaries.
What role does Al Jazeera and do other media outlets in the Muslim and Arab worlds play in exposing hypocrisies from within terrorist organizations?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know that they've played a large role in exposing that. And I think that's a missed opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about Terror Free Tomorrow and the work that you do with them.
Well, as I mentioned, we've done a lot of public opinion polling, and then through these interviews, I got involved in writing this book. And the idea is to understand the causes of extremism so we can respond most effectively. I'll give you just one example of what I mean by that. Recently, last month, an American drone strike killed this radical cleric, who was an American citizen in Yemen by the name of Anwar al-Awlaki. I'm not questioning whether that was the right thing to do or not. I don't know. But I think that what would have had more impact for people in the Muslim world is if we had exposed, indirectly, not directly, but if we had exposed the fact that al-Awlaki had been arrested 3 times and convicted for solicitation of prostitutes in the United States and was actually on probation for those charges, and there are a lot of facts relating to his activities. That would have done more to weaken the radical cause than simply killing him.
Hmm. I wonder if that's behind the fact that it was made very public that, you know, Osama bin Laden's lair had been found to contain pornography and Western movies and things that he would have denied to any of the people who followed him.
Unfortunately, though, that was done in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is unfortunate, but it's true. The credibility of the United States government around the world, and this is just not with Muslims or radicals, frankly, it's sometimes here at home, is very low right now. And I think when things come from a U.S. government source, they tend to not have terribly much impact. So I think the missed opportunity with Osama bin Laden was on his December 2001 impromptu taping after the 9/11 attacks, where at one point in the tape, he's filmed laughing at the fact that many of the hijackers, many of the terrorists on 9/11, didn't know they were going to their death, that he had tricked them into going, like Ahmad in the book in Saudi Arabia. I think if that tape had been more widely distributed throughout the Muslim world in Arabic with bin Laden talking and laughing at the fact that he had tricked people, that would have done a great deal to diminish his luster.
Another thing that hasn't even really come up in this conversation that's very interesting is the reality that some American funds that are sent to, for example, Pakistan, ultimately that money in part filters back to fund terrorism.
That's correct. I mean, one of the people portrayed in this book was a trainer of terrorists. He calls himself a career terrorist for Islam. And he is portrayed in the book. He spent 2 decades doing this. And for much of that time, he was actually paid for by the Pakistani army and its secret intelligence agency, the ISI. So he's training terrorists. with funds. You know, we've given Pakistan $20 billion since 9/11 with funds, and he's smuggling arms to the Taliban. So, as he said, the Americans are literally funding both sides in the war on terror.
Is the art of public opinion polling different according to culture? Do you have to structure questions in different ways? I mean, aside from the language issue, do you have to ask things in different ways?
Oh, absolutely. And also in different societies, I mean, there's certain questions you can't ask. And the more authoritarian the government is, the more careful you have to be about how you ask questions that elicit people's opinions, because sometimes they fear that, you know, those answers may get them in trouble. So it really depends on the country and it depends on the culture. And but again, people, you know, one universal kind of human trait that I find, no matter what culture people come from, they do like to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they do want to communicate and communicate their feelings. Not everyone. Some people feel they can't trust you, but what's surprising is how many can.
Did you find the women to be very well informed?
The women are more well informed than you might imagine from afar. And the women, you know, that's kind of the myth we have in the West so much, is that, you know, these women, or they're veiled or they're kept in seclusion. But if you can actually unveil them, if you will, metaphorically, not mm-hmm. literally. They want to talk, too. They have opinions. They have lives. They have feelings. They have emotions. I mean, you know, and the book shows that with the story of Miriam. I mean, she's the one who's very decisive in that relationship. She's the one who pursues Abby. She's the one who takes the lead. I mean, she's a very strong woman with a lot of opinions and, you know, wants to assert herself.
How are you different, Ken, having written this book, than you were before you started the first interview?
I mean, I think I see the complexity of these issues. I see the human interactions. I see the importance of love, if you will, in every culture. The importance of making human connections and understanding and communicating with people. Perhaps in a deeper way, and the absolute, you know, if we're all in this world together, and it's a shrinking world,
mm-hmm.
and we have to reach across these divides to touch people and to communicate with them. Look, not everyone is going to be our friends, but if we treat everyone as our enemies, we're doomed to failure. If we don't talk to you can't negotiate with everyone. Some people will just talk you to death and pursue their murderous policies. But if you talk to no one and that's your policy, that is a policy that's doomed to failure.
Ken Ballen's new book is called Terrorists in Love, The Real Lives of Islamic Radicals. Ken, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, and I appreciate your fine questions as well.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.